is correct.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Moments of Truth, the show about my favorite moments from my favorite things. I'm Bill Coffin, and today we'll be discussing our favorite banned books. Now, in our efforts to showcase positive thoughts about positive things, we here at Moments of Truth tend to stay away from the classic sex, religion, and politics trifecta to keep the show as accessible as possible. That said, we won't be doing that in this episode because we take a pretty dim view of censorship. So if that bothers you, then you're welcome to listen to another podcast. Book banning is nothing new. Since antiquity, people in power have banned books for challenging someone's sense of racial, religious, sexual, or political supremacy. In the United States, perhaps the first nationwide book ban was in 1852 on Harriet Beecher Stowe's anti-slavery novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which touched more than a few nerves in the national argument over slavery that would become the Civil War. In 1873, the Comstock Act granted authorities such vague license to prohibit anything deemed sexually obscene that it and its successor laws have snared everything from Ernest Hemingway to Geoffrey Chaucer ever since. From the 1880s through the 1940s, the New England Watch and Ward Society in Boston ran such a zealous morality crusade against anything it deemed immoral that the Boston Public Library had to keep challenged books locked in a special room that they called the Inferno. And in the 1980s, Reagan-era social conservatism prompted such a sharp uptick in book banning that the American Library Association began Banned Books Week in 1982 to celebrate the freedom to read. But this is nothing compared to the explosion in book banning that we've seen since 2021, in which politically conservative groups like Moms for Liberty have spearheaded more than 2,500 separate book bans on some 1,700 unique titles from school classrooms and libraries across the country, but mainly in Texas, Florida, Tennessee, and Pennsylvania. The bans have mostly targeted titles that explore LGBTQ plus issues, themes of racism, or anything critical of Christianity. State governors and legislators have pressured public libraries to remove books from the shelves that address topics like critical race theory or transgender identity. And public libraries themselves have become battlegrounds in a culture war that seeks to defund libraries entirely or have them reported to the police on spurious accusations of distributing pornography to children. The truth is, America is becoming an increasingly progressive place. And every time it takes a step forward on gender, race, religion, or something else, there's a drive to ban books in an effort to control the American narrative. But no matter how heavy-handed these bans are or try to be, they can never overcome the power of great literature to speak marvelously about important things, to ignite the imagination, and to spread a love for learning. So with that, let's get started. With me today is Chris Superfudge Crenshaw.
Are you there, God? It's me, Chris.
Lost in a drug-fueled haze somewhere in Vienna, it's Tom Hespos. New Hampshire's eighth greatest literary export, Joe Pace.
I gotta tell you, I've never shied away from sex or politics.
And we have a very special guest with us this episode. We have the proponent of the $10,000 late fee, Liz Miller.
Listen, I gotta pay for my vacation somehow.
Outstanding. Everyone, welcome. So before we get started, I want to just introduce Liz to our listeners here. Liz is a friend of everyone on the show one way or another, because our world is an increasingly small place. Liz, why don't you just introduce yourself, what you do for a living, and why tonight's topic was interesting enough for you to join the show for us.
Hi, so my name is Liz Miller. I am a reference librarian at the Millburn Public Library in New Jersey. And I have been doing this job for about 7 years. I've been in public libraries for about 10. I did some corporate positions before that, but I've been doing public library work for about 10 years. There's definitely been like a change in the past couple of years that we have experienced. And we haven't personally had that much in our actual library of people trying to ban books, but it's all around us. I mean, it's not just in Florida and Texas and Tennessee and places where you think it is. Like, we have recently had a situation like five towns over where five or six books were trying to be banned. And it was a group. I'm not even sure that they lived in the community, but they wanted to ban these books. And something like 150 people came out to stop that from happening. But it's just, you know, to say that it's not just in places that are far away. It's around here as well. So
Liz, I have to ask, in your capacity as a librarian, have you ever had somebody come into the library and kind of get in your face personally over a book that they wanted pulled from the shelf, or a book that they just had to be in their bonnet about and just kind of freaked out over, and you've had to like confront this directly?
No, I haven't had that happen to me directly. I have had other confrontations about other things, but about banning books.
Libraries are a weird place, right?
Yeah.
Stop with the porn, sir.
Seriously.
Sometimes I'm like, how did I get here? But no, so nobody has actually come in and asked that. However, in the past year or so, we have had several meetings with staff on how to handle it once that happens, because I do think that it will happen. We have gotten requests of, oh, maybe this book shouldn't be in the children's room. And so we take a look at it and we say, maybe this book is more appropriate for the teen space or the adult space, not usually the adult space, but the teen space. And that is part of what our training is that we are supposed to give them a form to fill out and not really engage with anyone, you know, yelling at us. If someone were to come in and yell at us,
fill out this form.
Yes.
Yeah. Don't break your crayon, jerk.
Yeah. Triplicate.
And one of the questions is, have you read the book?
Yeah.
Because it's a fair question, actually. It's absolutely. And in your intro, you were talking about how there's something like 2000 bans, not bans, but people attempting to do bans. And I saw that number as well. And it said something like 40% of the challenges are of 100 books or more. Yeah. So it's not the increase is not really. Yeah, it's not really one person saying, I don't think that 50 Shades of Grey should be in the kids' room. It's, you know, people coming in with like a list of like 100 books and saying, you have to get rid of them.
Yeah, I want this entire tranche of content just taken off the public, public list. Right. So you get the feeling that these bans are about something more than simply potentially offensive literature?
I mean, to me, it seems like it is really just about controlling the narrative, right? Controlling what people are allowed to access. When I was a kid, I've told this story a few times, probably. I don't know if any of you guys have heard it, but when I was in like second or third grade, I had just moved to a new school and I wanted to read some book. And the librarian there was like, read me the first paragraph and tell me what it means, because it was pretty far above my grade level. And I did. And then I went home and I told my mom, and my mom, who's a big proponent of me fighting my own battles, went down to the librarian and was like, you let my kid check out whatever book she wants. I was just talking to her about that this morning, and she's like, I think maybe they did it because they didn't have that many books to start with. And I'm like, no, you're not changing the story. The story is you stood up for me.
We are recording this on Mother's Day.
That's not how I recall it.
Yeah, that's not what I remember. But I always remember that like I was offended that this librarian wanted me to like tell her what it meant. And one of the things that we do is sometimes we'll have a parent come in and ask about books for their kid. It's always better when the kid comes in, but of course, you know, a parent comes in and they want to like find stuff. And my feeling is always, if your kid is too young to read it, they will stop reading it, or it will go over their heads, right? I read a lot of stuff that I did not understand, and I just like skimmed right over it. And I feel like, you know, let them read what they want to read.
I was in seventh grade trying to read the Fellowship of the Ring, and I couldn't get through it. And like, it's like, if kids don't want to read, they're not going to read it. You know, the stuff they want to read, and they, is in their world.
Liz, let me ask you this. Let's imagine you're at the desk one day in the library, and somebody comes in. They're you know, 12, 13 years old, and they're like, hey, look, I really want to read like All Boys Aren't Blue, or I really want to read Gender Queer, or I really want to read, you know, The Lawn Boy, or any of the other novels that are currently just in the book banning crosshairs right now, but I'm afraid that somebody's going to see me reading this, and I'm afraid of what's going to happen. Well, as somebody who's kind of a custodian for how people can access literature and for serving the public in this way, what, you know, and I don't want to get you in trouble with the library where you work. I mean, obviously you've got your own policies and procedures, but just in a perfect hypothetical state, right? You're at the library that exists in your mind, and a kid comes in, they want to access one of these books, but they're afraid to do so. What would you tell them?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a little bit hard for me to answer that question because I do, like, both the town I live in and the town I work in are pretty progressive in a lot of ways. So I have to think about it a little bit. I think that honestly, what I would do is see if they had a device that they could read it on as an ebook.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. So like if that was a concern. Yeah. That's on my business card.
Or you just give them a Sports Illustrated to put on the outside of it.
Like yeah, used to do in class. That's another option. Option.
Yeah.
I know that that's a thing, you know, the Brooklyn Library has books, what's it called? Books on Band. They started this, and then Seattle Public Library is doing it as well, where they are giving free access to kids who are teens. And, you know, it's such a great idea. It does, you know, it does mean that you have to have a device, right?
Yeah.
You have to have some sort of electronic device, and that is problematic in some areas. But probably that's what I would suggest.
Yeah. I have read.
If that was a concern.
Yeah, it's along the lines of, I've read that there's some Minecraft server out there that what it is, it's basically like a great big, like somebody built like the Library of Alexandria or whatever, but within the server, they have stored this enormous trove of text files of books that are banned in various countries around the world. So if you live in a country where this book is banned, you can log on to this Minecraft server and download the book without your government knowing, right? Which is such an ingenious solution, and I so salute everybody involved in making that solution happen. But it also, it kind of explains, like, you can't really constrict ideas, and you can't really constrict literature. And you know, I think Oscar Wilde mentioned that, like, you know, the books we ban simply reflect our shame back upon ourselves. And I think the more you're trying to ban a book, the more you're really expressing what it is that you like least about yourself.
Always says more about you than the book.
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely. Definitely.
Just at any time, always remember that Thomas Paine was banned in Britain and in Russia, and 200,000 copies of The Rights of Man were burned in Britain and in Russia. And in 1946, the United States State Department banned Common Sense by Thomas Paine.
Dude cannot catch a break, man.
That's
so dumb.
I suspect that's going to be the theme of the evening, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so goddamn dumb.
I imagine it's going to be. And we're going to get into our selections in just a moment. But before we do, Liz, I just have one more question for you, which is, you know, before we started recording, we were talking about the books you want to talk about. And you very, you know, pointedly mentioned, like, that's a lot of white guys we're going to be discussing. And as we mentioned, like, this show.
And
like,
women. White women.
Yeah. You know, but like, we try to say this, you know, when it's right, there's an enormous amount of privilege amongst the cast of the show, right? You know, we have to acknowledge that. When you look at lists of the most commonly banned books out, you know, like the books that got banned when we were kids, there just weren't as many books being banned, first of all. But the ones that were being banned, if you compare them to the books that are being banned now, the diversity of the authors themselves today is much broader. In terms of the books being banned, as well as just the diversity of books, the books themselves. And Liz, I just love to get your thoughts on that. You know, you see this from a librarian's perspective. You know, does that make you think of anything, or is there anything you take away from that phenomenon?
Well, I think that you make a very valid point, which is that the people who are writing have a lot. There's a lot more variety in those voices, right? That will make bans more universal. But I, you know, when we started talking about this, doing this podcast, I took a little look just from my own experience and like the books that are banned now and then the books that, you know, we're going to talk about tonight. And it's very different. And you touched on this in your intro, now it's really about like LGBTQ people. It's about critical race theory and racism and things like that. And I feel like the ones that were during when we were growing up, you know, it was about religion or
sex,
bodily functions. Yeah. So yeah, sex,
coarse
or,
language,
you know, yeah, whatever. Yeah. One of the books that I was so angry about that they wanted to ban in the town a few towns over from me was this book called It's Perfectly Normal, which is basically just like a guide of for adolescents and teens of like how your body's changing and very like very direct. I mean, there's full illustrations, nudity, that sort of thing. Talks about masturbation and birth control and you know, same-sex relationships and gender identity and everything. And I mean, that was one of the ones, and it made me furious because here's this, you know, just an explanation of what's happening. I feel like I got away from your question a little bit, but
no, not at all.
But yeah, I feel like now we see, because we're seeing so much more of that sort of information, like when we were growing up, were there even any books that talked about like boys liking boys? Not really.
Yeah,
right? Or girls liking girls like that?
No.
That was,
well, there was
not
some,
a thing.
Yeah.
So what's always interesting to me is how like just the mythology we tell ourselves about how the country works, how men and women are, how money changes hands, all those things. Books increasingly challenge the falsehoods that are baked into that mythology. And I think that's what, when those falsehoods get challenged, is when people rise up to defend them because they benefit from those falsehoods, right?
Which you is know, which is why critical race theory in particular is,
oh my God, yeah,
so widely challenged now.
Which isn't a thing.
Well, it's amazing when you see people who are like, we need to ban these books on CRT because, you know, and you're like, well, what is CRT? I don't know. Like, it's almost like the whole thing on pornography. I know it when I see it.
But that it's telling me I'm the bad guy.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, well, okay, you probably are, dude. That's all I can tell you there.
Well, so. I mean, so much of like, of, you know, white straight fragility is at the core of this. And it's, I can't allow for there to be anything that challenges the hegemony to which I subscribe.
Yeah.
And I don't want my children exposed to anything that challenges what I've taught them.
Because if they do learn to question it, they might realize I'm an asshole.
Well, they know it already. They just might get confirmation that I'm an asshole.
Yeah. Independent confirmation that your parents are jerks are like, you know, that, there's no coming back from that.
Yeah. Meathead was right. Okay.
Oh man, that's a great name of an album or something. So. All right, so let's get started here. So what we're going to do is I'm just going to roll the die of destiny here, see who goes first.
The die of destiny.
Oh no,
that's a new Indiana Jones movie, right? The die of destiny.
He just threw that right on the ground. This episode is cursed.
Wipe it. Exactly. Wipe it. Doesn't count.
One.
I don't care what it
Tom
was.
Tom Hespos, you are up first, sir.
Oh,
so
boy.
So why don't you talk to us about the book you chose. Give us a quick rundown, just sort of, you know, the back of the cover sort of synopsis. So what is the book about? Why do you love it so much? And then get in a little bit about to what was it like, why and when, you know, what was it banned for? And let's, and we'll talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. So I chose Persepolis, Marjan Satrapi. I hope I'm getting that right. It's a graphic novel about a girl growing up in Iran as it's going through the Islamic Revolution. She's growing up in this sort of, you know, secular, you know, almost progressive type of family environment where, you know, she's not buying any of this stuff that the incoming theocracy is selling. So, you know, there are a bunch of like atrocious and like crazy things that happen to her as she's growing up, including, you know, bombs blowing up the neighbor's house, and, you know, one of her friends is killed, you know, an uncle gets tortured. There's a bunch of like really horrific things that happen to her along the way. You know, she gets shipped off to Vienna for a bit for her safety, but also, you know, for her ongoing education, and, you know, ends up at a school there where circumstance has it that she ends up almost like homeless in that country and, you know, has to go back to Iran. I love the book because growing up as somebody whose like impressions of Iran were like shaped by things like the hostage crisis and, you know, OPEC long lines and things like that. Like, you know, I never really looked much into the history of that revolution or like what was really involved there. And, you know, I scooped up a copy of this, you know, basically it's the omnibus edition where they
that's one I've read
all of the, you know, the volumes of Persepolis 1 and 2, and it's all in one. I picked this up during sort of like the Streisand effect of, you know, them trying to ban it in, you know, 2013 or so. As far as bans go, this is kind of like an interesting one because it started in Chicago of all places. And like the Chicago public school system basically yanked it from everywhere in the school system overnight. And they did it without following any of like the usual process or procedures that they have for challenging books.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole thing was this sort of like process of like why everybody was figuring, you know, everybody's trying to figure out like why they were so interested in banning this book. Reasons were given, you know, like, oh, we don't like the depictions of torture, you know, like the depictions that they specifically objected to were, you know, an image of Marjan's uncle basically being like tortured with an iron. But like, you know, we're not talking about Marvel Comics here. It isn't like graphic. The illustrations are pretty rudimentary. Like, for someone to get creeped out by that, you know, is a little, you know.
It's a spurious complaint.
It's a spurious complaint. And there were a bunch of spurious complaints. Yeah. But, like, you land on Islamophobia eventually. And, you know, somebody, you know, who said during the process of figuring out why this is so objectionable was like, well, why are you assigning a book, you know, on Islam so close to 9/11? And, like, boom,
there it is.
Right there. Yeah,
exactly. Okay. There it is. There it is.
We drilled and we found the core. Yeah. And
how dare this book actually humanize the people of Iran and show them to be more than a mere caricature? They've got some guts doing that, I'll tell you.
Is this really the time, people?
Right. Exactly. But, too soon.
When you read through this, there's, you know, like the family is, you know, they're not a fan of the Shah, and they're, you know, they hate the theocracy even worse, but, you know, like, they're protesting pretty much throughout all of this book,
yeah,
and you're finding out the reasons why, and you're seeing their run-ins with the morality police and all this stuff that's going on. And, you know, for me anyway, you know, I read this like pretty much right after the ban. I just did a reread, but like, you know, you start to see a lot of parallels to our current situation in America, you know, where people just love to call the morality police on one another and, you know, head to the library and get rid of books or whatever else.
The actual
You know, if you're wondering, like, you know, how a theocracy can creep in the course of, you know, basically a year or two, and, you know, how that affects people who are, you know, when the theocratic government comes in and you're like this secular family who likes to party and likes to, you know, not wear veils and, you know, go out in public and drink alcohol and all those things. Like, you know, it's very eye-opening. Like, I didn't know very much about families that had that sort of attitude who were living in Iran. You know, like, I think I saw a photo one time of, you know, on Reddit or something where, you know, there's a group of women, you know, congregating in front of a school or something during the 60s in Iran. And they look very, you know, westernized and, you know, kind of like
they were styling back then, man. Yeah. It was awesome. 60s,
yeah.
You know, they were
all brunette,
but you know, he also introduced a lot of, you know, progressive stuff to, you know, and modernized the country. Yes. So, you know, you know, how does a country that's on that path go to this, you know, brutal sort of theocracy within the course of a year or two? And like, it's really
happened so fast.
Just seeing that through her eyes, you know, I recommend it to like anybody who's got that sort of curiosity about how those things happen, you know, and the fact that it you know came to us through, what amounts to a very, you know, sort of flawed character who has this just amazing journey figuring out who she is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fantastic story. And like, I don't mind that the art, you know, usually in graphic novels, I look for, you know, great art and stuff like that. But like, it's like the art was a punctuation mark to the story in my
I felt the art was ultimately really appropriate for the way the story was being told. And I mean, you know, it's a little cartoony, but like I very quickly was able to sync with it, like by about page three or four, you know, I was like, okay, now I get it. This is the vibe. It works. What really captured me about Persepolis was, especially like in the first volume where we're seeing things actually happen, like you said, and they're just like, they've kind of got this sort of slow rolling sense of disbelief. Like, surely it's not going to go where they want this to go. That's impossible. Right. And there's this great scene where she's in like a full, she's like fully veiled for the first time. And she and all her friends are like, this is so dumb. This is so stupid. And they're just like, and talking about how they're like sabotaging it. And like some guy from the morality police comes by and they all pitch rocks at them. Like, ha, get lost, jerk, you know? And it's just this great moment, but like, she's growing up at this time when the whole world changes. And it's like, growing up is tough, no matter who you are, no matter where you are, but her whole world turns upside down when she's turning upside down as a person. Mm-hmm. And you get this great sense of how, like, after that, when she leaves Iran, like, she's a person without a home. Like, she doesn't feel at home. She's an Iranian abroad, doesn't feel at home where she is in Vienna, tries going back, doesn't feel at home in Iran because she's been outside for too long, and she's unmoored, you know? And I really felt for her. I felt for her in a huge way because, like, you know, she's just looking to find some place where she can put down roots and feel like she belongs and live her life. That's all she wants to do is live her life.
To me, like, closest comp that I had looking at Persepolis was honestly Diary of Anne Frank, which has been banned for very similar reasons.
Yeah.
Which is, you have a young girl coming of age, discovering herself, some of which involves sexuality, some of which involves, you know, a lot of evil in the world around her and being displaced by it. And I think it's fascinating that if you look around at all of the books we choose for tonight and a lot of the books in that are being banned, a lot of them have to do with adolescents grappling with the world that they're coming into a certain hegemony trying to control children's understanding of their world before they even enter it.
Yeah.
But banning books is always, always about who you're trying to repress or oppress.
Yeah.
And it's disproportionately children.
Well, right. Because, you know, the people that ban books don't read much.
No.
Typically. And they're afraid of people who do, especially children who do.
Yeah.
Like
children
I said,
are voraciously curious.
The child that reads Persepolis grows up to understand that it's not really as simple as Islam is evil and Christianity is good.
Right.
And that kind of, you know, nuance is just foreign to some folks.
Yeah.
They can't accept it.
Liz, your thoughts?
I read Persepolis a while ago, and while you were recounting it, Tom, it reminded me of reading Lolita in Tehran, which is a not graphic novel, but similar. And that book, what I remember from it mostly is these people trying to live their lives. And then so fast, it happened so fast while they were just like raising their kids or growing up or whatever. And that fear kind of stayed with me for both of those books when I read them. Because it's just like, you're just out here trying to, you know, make it to work on time or whatever. And, you know, people in government are doing these things and they do end up affecting your lives a lot of ways in very serious ways.
It happens just so quickly, you know, like one moment.
It's so fast.
They're going to protests and they're, you know, having these like parties in their apartment. And the next minute they're like pouring all the alcohol down the toilet because the morality police are on their way up, you know, like, and that just happens so quickly. But also, Bill, I wanted to get back to one of the things that you said too, because it has to do with my moment of truth. The notion that she's just, you know, unmoored, it comes out in a great way too, because it's held like in contrast against her parents, who are very much moored to Iran, and they will send her off to foreign countries for her education or for her safety, but they stay put. You know, they're going to continue doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's something that leads to, you know, a lot of conflict, a lot of, you know, I don't understand, you know, why my parents are this way, that kind of thing. But like, a lot of it comes to a head, like right at the end of the book, where she is saying goodbye to her parents because she is going to leave Iran for good. And, you know, her father, like, and she's, by the way, in the middle of getting divorced, something that could be actually fatal for her in this right. Iran, you know, that,
yeah.
you know, when she's 20 something, you know, early 20s, her mother and father are at the airport. And there's this moment where almost everything's just sort of coming to summation. And her father says, you know, with regard to her decision to leave the country and get divorced, she says, "We're very happy with your decision. You weren't made to live here. We're Iranians. We're crushed not only by the government, but by the weight of our traditions." So this is the father understanding it's not just the theocracy, it's the tradition around mm-hmm. us as well. Mm-hmm. Some of which isn't, you know, coming from the religion, but, you know, just how we do things.
Yeah,
that is crushing us. But, you know, they're going to stay and they're going to fight it out while their daughter leaves the country, you know, never to be seen by them again. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah.
That was just such a moment of truth for me. Like, you know, there's all the pain of her having to leave her, you know, her country and her parents and everything and her family, you know, everybody she knows there, you know, on top of that contrast of like her parents are very much moored there to the point where they're stuck.
I think about that too, like in my life, right? Particularly with like Roe v. Wade being overturned. I have a daughter who is a young, you know, adult. And I'm like, should she go to another country? Like, that's something that I grapple with a lot. And I mean, I would probably stay here. It's the similar, but like, what do you do? It's so hard as a parent and it's so hard as a kid, I think, to do either, you know, to leave like that. But
yeah. Yeah. And I think there are a lot of people who are like, I wouldn't stay. I would just leave. And like, that's easier said than done. You know, like I've had the benefit of travel. I've been to a lot of different places. And one thing I know about myself is that I may be out of step culturally with a lot of my fellow Americans, but I am an American. Like, I am very much an American. And I know were I to live in another country, I would feel deeply out of place there. Even a country I love, a country I really want to be, a country I feel like and vibe with, I would feel very much not at home. And I have never, we talked about privilege before, I have never had the sense that I'm not at home more so than maybe being at college or something, right?
If you go to New Zealand, the problem is they don't have mini shredded wheat. It's the huge shredded wheat that you got to break up in your own bowl. And you will never feel like an alien more than breaking up that shredded wheat in your own bowl. That's messed up.
I just can't live like this, man. Come on.
It's chaos.
It's chaos. No, but
Weetabix. What is this?
Weetabix. Exactly. Weetabix. Thank you very much. From the package.
Vegemite. Thing. What am I, an animal? Yeah. Yeah. No. No. But you know, it's funny. I didn't read.
Vegemite is nothing compared to Marmite. Settle down.
That is true. Marmite will kill a man. So I read an enormous amount of graphic novels. And
what? No.
I know it's a crazy revelation, but it's true. But I had not read Persepolis until last year, actually. You know, I was going through and I was like, you know, I just need to read this. And there are a couple I hadn't, and I actually had not read Mouse either. So I read the two almost like back to back. But I read Persepolis, was blown away by it. And it was right around the time when the Mahsa Amini protests started getting going in Iran. And I think I read Persepolis before all that happened. But as that happened, I kept thinking about this book. And I kept thinking about the character in it and just how all these women in Iran are just like, they're just fighting for their lives. You know, they're just fighting for things that are easily taken for granted elsewhere. And it's you're talking about that weight, Tom, like the weight of your traditions, the weight of the way things are. It's easy to say you'd fight against it, right? But man, I've never had to carry that weight before. I don't even know what that weight, I don't even know what that weight feels like.
We're four white dudes.
Right. Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
You can even see in the book where that becomes overwhelming at times. I mean, for her folks, you know, because like they're used to going out and doing all the protests and all that neat stuff. And times when, like, all of a sudden their daughter's life is in danger. And you know what? They turn around. Like, there are ways, you know, getting people to comply, and they hit their limit, you know? And then that's very much a reality in this book. And, it you know, exploring that, I think, is important for everybody to do.
Bill, I'm glad you brought up Mouse, because it's an obvious comparison to Persepolis. And there's very little funnier in a macabre sense in this whole discussion than the reasons that Mouse was banned.
Oh my God.
Those are naked mice.
For sure. Yeah. No, actually, it was a person.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I went back and said the same thing. And then I went back and I looked at it, and it is a woman's breast.
It is a woman's breast, and she's in a concentration camp.
Yeah.
Yes, there's nothing sexual at all about the age. Yeah. It's a grotesque image.
Yeah. I think of that. I think Neil Gaiman said it best. He tweeted out, he goes, "There's only one kind of people who would vote to ban Mouse, whatever they're calling themselves these days."
Right.
Perfect.
It's like, thank you, Neil. You say it right every time, my man. I love you. Thank you.
Yeah,
so
is that titillating to you?
Exactly. Right? Exactly. No, these reasons never hold up to rational explanation, but it's not about reason. It's just about, I don't know.
Well, it's about reasons.
And that ban happened in Tennessee, which I mentioned before. That's like one of the hotbeds of book banning. So just that, with everything else that comes with it. One thing I will say, one final thing real quick, is that, Tom, when you mentioned this choice, a book that came to mind for me was this book called That One Summer. It's a really terrific coming of age story that I highly recommend. And I loved it. I think it came out in like 2014. It got banned because one of the characters is lesbian, and it talks about, you know, sexual issues and that sort of thing. It's just growing up stuff, right? It's just this summer. It's like a slice of life story that really has no clear beginning or end, other than this young woman's trip out to the lake for the summer and her just hanging out there. And it's just her life, right? And it's so well done, and it's so human. That got on the radar because that won the Caldecott Honor, right?
Oh my God.
Okay, so the Caldecott Honor.
Caldecott's getting banned. I love it.
Well, yeah, that's what happened. So for those of you who don't know, there's the Newbery Award, which, and by the way, Liz, check me on this, I'm getting it wrong. Okay, so there's the Newbery Award, which is kind of like the Oscar for children's literature, right?
Let's have the Lloyd Alexander Award.
And then there's the Caldecott Award, which goes to picture books. But what's happened is that graphic novels have become this thing, and so That One Summer qualified, right? Because it's a graphic tale. When the Caldecott Award landed on that one, a lot of people are like, okay, well, what's this book about? And then that's what put on the radar of people who wanted to ban it, and it became this kerfuffle that should not have happened. But, you know, I'm a big proponent of graphic novels as a medium, right? And I read a ton of like non-superhero graphic novels that just are remarkable pieces of literature. And I think the stuff we've seen with Persepolis and with Mouse and with That One Summer, I think we can see more of that as people challenge graphic novels, because they're seen, even if they're meant for young adults or for new adults or for adults, the kinds of people who ban books are only going to ever see them as children's things. And so the only thing that they ever see them as is they're trying to groom kids for something that we deem unacceptable. So I think
they're easier targets too, because you can hold a picture up and
out
of context always.
Look at that.
Yeah, exactly.
And the number one banned book in 2022 is Gender Queer, which is a graphic novel as well. I don't know if anybody has read that. I read it recently. And I mean, there's a couple pictures that are, you know, maybe not appropriate for your 5-year-old, but it seemed like when I looked
it
up
terrifying.
Today, I know. I looked it up today, and it's about someone who is non-binary, which, again, something we would not have read about 20 years ago or 30 years ago. I looked it up in our consortium. We're part of like a group of libraries, and most of the libraries had it in young adult, right? So like that seems appropriate to me. It was either young adult or adult fiction, right? So that is appropriate. Part of what I do, because I mostly work with adult stuff, but not adult stuff.
There's a special room in back of the library.
Everything's in
not
a brown
that kind
paper
of library,
bag.
You guys. But I don't really deal that much with the kids stuff. But there is always a case to be made if someone comes and says, we don't think this should be in the kids' room, right? Yeah. Like that is something that is a valid, that can be a valid complaint. Yeah.
Like a Ron DeSantis biography, like don't put that in the kids' room.
Think of the children, would you please?
Kids' room. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Exactly.
So what I will say, actually, since you mentioned that, is that we have gotten complaints on occasion that we don't have enough right-leaning books in our adult fiction, or I'm sorry, in our adult section.
That's fiction. It's still
right there.
It's still fiction.
Yeah, no, that was a Freudian
Yeah, no, you're right. Fiction.
But I never really understand what they're talking about because we buy all of the. I mean, we have
Nikki
DeSantis, we have Pence, we have Haley, we have Pompeo, I just checked, we have that.
All of these people who have never read a book but wrote a book,
right?
Somehow miraculously.
Yes.
Well, I think the problem with that categorization, Liz, is the reality is that 90% of these books are pop-up books, right? So where do you put them in a library?
Right.
I mean, seriously.
Bill, bite your tongue. They're coloring books.
Oh, this is true. This is true.
Well, so, they got to be putting out the right-wing memoirs, probably 10-to-1 ratio.
Can you imagine being a literate ghostwriter who has to pen that garbage? You're like, I'm a professional writer, and I just got hired by Mike Pence to write his bilious claptrap into something approximating...
I assume it's the same guy that made Rush Limbaugh famous. I think that the guy that wrote Rush Limbaugh's books has written all of them.
In my head canon, it's somebody who worked on Marlon Brando, right? And so they're just like, it's okay.
I know the guy, by the way.
Mr. Will judge me kindly for Marlon Brando.
I went to high school with a guy who ghost wrote for Donald Trump and was in on Art of the Deal. And he has, by the way, repeatedly said, this is the most...
You were still in high school when Art of the Deal came out. What the
hell?
He
was a little older than me, but whatever. We went to the same high school.
Oh, no. I love the idea of him getting a high schooler to go write that book.
That's perfect.
Let's stick with that.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, Mark D'Agostino, who went to my high school and I know, was like, and you know what? You're
kids
right.
Fresh off Ayn Rand and writing for Donald Trump. That's how that dream goes.
I don't think he was in on Art of the Deal, but he did interviews and later stuff with Trump. And he has been outspoken about the fact that he felt like Clippy on the old Microsoft Word for somebody that was basically hitting the keyboard with a hammer.
Yeah. Yeah.
That anyway,
tracks. Wait, you're suggesting that these guys don't all write their own books?
You know, honestly, and I have Cory Booker's book and Pete Buttigieg's book, and I know they got help too. It's not just a right wing thing.
You know
what I mean? Wait a minute, are you saying politicians have speech writers?
Wake up, sheeple.
Yeah,
exactly. But one of my all time favorite lines was when Jose Canseco was asked what his favorite book was, and he said, it's the first one I'll read. And I keep thinking about all these guys when I hear them.
Yeah. So excellent. Well, we're gonna move on to the next section here. So I'm gonna roll the die of destiny and see where we go. So it's six. So basically it's Chris Crenshaw. So
why don't
you walk us through the book you chose, who wrote it, what's about, why it got banned, and why do you love it?
When I was young, the elementary school library was a really big deal to me. You know, we didn't get to go every day, you went once a week or whatever. And I would load up. First or second grade, I found Beverly Cleary. I loved Ramona. And Beverly Cleary leads you naturally to Judy Blume. I read the Fudge books and I loved them. I'm pretty sure that my school library had Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I don't think that was banned.
It had to have.
The purple cover and the blonde girl.
That book was inescapable at that time. It was everywhere.
Judy Blume is I think maybe the most banned author of all. She's had as many as 7, I think, of her books in the top 100 most banned books. The American Library Association releases a decade by decade list of the most banned books. Although, actually, in this decade, she's doing okay. But the books that she wrote that have been banned, in particular, Forever, and Tiger Eyes, Deanie, Blubber. Oh. And even Are You There, God With Me, Margaret. They're all stories that tell young girls and young women about what the next few years of their life is going to be like. And they try to prepare them for them, for those years. I really do think that Judy Blume is a genius. She has her work is
national treasure.
Just, it's amazing. And the fact that her characters make readers aware that they're going to have a period, or that, you know, they might want to rub down there one day, or boys can be fun to rub up against. The degree to which book bans have tried to control young women is just astounding to me and nauseating. I get more worked up about Judy Blume bans than anything, because they're just such wholesome books. Yeah. They're so wholesome. Yeah. They're just trying to help, right? They're here to help.
Yeah.
And the idea that a parent just cannot stand the thought of their daughter reading about someone lusting for a young man, it's baffling. If I have a moment of truth about Judy Blume, it's on a book that I haven't even read, Forever, which is about pubescent girl, young girl who has a boyfriend, and they're going to love each other forever, and they have sex, and her parents find out and separate them. And here's the moment of truth. She responds by starting a relationship with her tennis instructor, her adult tennis instructor.
That is, it's
like Judy Blume saw what was coming with these bans and said, this is what you're going to get. The way in which book bans want to deny agency, in particular, in this case, to young women, is I think the whole point of them. You know, we're right now, conservative panickers are trying to deny agency and existence to transsexual people, you know, as though their lives were affected by them in any way. I don't know what's so threatening about a young woman knowing that she's going to have a period or that she's going to want to have sex one day. I don't know. But that we find it so terrible is awful.
You know, as well as I do, it's not about that. It's all about what you can weaponize politically. Right. And create those wedge issues. Like, it's not
now that's true, Joe. Now that's true. Outcome,
right.
That is true now. But in the 70s, I don't think that was the story.
Even then, John Birch and Goldwater, you know what I mean? Like, there was even as
that early stuff was starting, 70s, yeah.
They had identified the capacity to weaponize culture because it was the counterculture to the 60s, which they said this will mobilize the suburban white terrified voter.
In a historical context, you're right. I would say, though, that in the 70s, they did not have the grassroots presence to make, you know, people look for those bands. I don't think that those bands came from that movement. I think that was just, you know, pearl clutching grandmothers and mothers. Personally,
I gotta get from Liz on this.
I was gonna say, like, Liz, I'm dying to hear what you have to say about this on a number of fronts, so please, the mic is yours.
So I have a couple of things to say about this. I also loved Judy Blume, although I'm not sure I ever read Beverly Cleary. I think I just skipped right to Judy Blume.
Most
I know
motorcycles
I
are calling for you.
I did it the other way. Judy Blume was my gateway to Beverly Cleary, but yeah.
Oh yeah, I should go back. But what I was mostly thinking about while you were talking, particularly about like who was doing the banning, is I was looking at all of you and I'm like, I think I'm the only one who grew up in like the rural South, right? So like, no, Chris, you grew up in Richmond.
Oh, no, she's calling you a city boy.
I grew up in Hanover County. I grew up in Hanover County, Liz.
She's like, listen to your city mouse.
It has been described in the national press as the most conservative county in America.
It's Yunkin country.
Right. I will. I'll allow that then. But I also, all right, I'm going to say it a different way then. I think I'm the only one who grew up in the rural South as a female.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Really?
And
you're a tricky one, Miller. Well, you got us. Okay.
Yeah. Listen, I'm always,
she's always thinking.
One step ahead.
Exactly. She's a slippery one.
And I grew up in like very evangelical Christian.
It was more liberal, I must admit.
Disappointment you must be to your family.
Yeah.
No, they were super liberal too.
Yeah.
My mom is a big like listen to NPR on the way to work and So now I listen to NPR on the way to work and my daughter makes fun of me. She's like, "Oh, you're one of those Trader Joe's moms."
Shots fired. That's not cool.
Leave
mom alone, man.
It's cold.
It's cold.
It's so true, though.
Yeah, obviously.
Let's go to CSA. Obviously
but Trader Joe's slaps. I mean, leave it alone, man. Come on.
So she true. Must go but it's like paycheck. It's like an NPR. Yeah, no, she doesn't do that. But it's like an NPR Trader Joe's something. There's a couple other things. I live in a very progressive town, right?
Yeah.
But I grew up in a place where people were literally like, I went to my friend's baptism where she was dunked in a river completely under, like she was completely dunked.
It was Oh Brother Where Art Thou?
Yeah. It was, yes. And it took a long time for me to like,
make no sense.
It took a long time for me to recognize that I was different from that environment.
Yeah.
And like in retrospect now, I'm like, wow, I really, really, really did not fit in. This is somewhat unrelated, but it goes to the point of how much I didn't fit in. We had like a mock vote in my like government class or whatever, social studies class. For Reagan and Mondale.
I can see this, yeah.
You're the one Mondale voter. You were Massachusetts in that election.
I was the one Mondale voter.
What is wrong with you?
Shocked by it. I was shocked. I was like,
bring your electoral vote there,
one?
Minnesota.
Yeah.
So the bands.
Liz has the best. Liz has the best origin story, by the way.
The bands of something like Judy Blume is not surprising to me based on where I grew up, right? So I think that maybe gives another tint to the story of my mom saying to the librarian, you let my kid check out whatever she wants, right?
Yeah.
Because there were in that town, it wasn't even a town, in that community, there was a lot of like very oppressive, you know, you go to church all the time, you like aren't gonna have sex before you get married, you know, or whatever. I don't know. Like
Stacy's daughter missed church the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then once you get married,
having sex,
just lay there and take it.
Think of England.
I don't know.
Wifely
but also
duty.
Like so many people got married right after high school, I think because they really probably wanted to have sex, right?
Well, they were 14 and they married a 40-year-old guy.
Dude, they had sex if they were getting married, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
No, I mean, not necessarily, man. Deep in the hinterlands.
I don't believe this for a minute.
My grandmother, and this is the rural north, my grandmother said, children come after 9 months. The first one can come anytime. But after that, they come after 9 months.
Wow. Are you Irish?
Kinda. This is the North. Everybody's Irish. But you know,
right.
I have to say with Judy Blume, like I loved Judy Blume. She was the balladeer of my preteen into my tween and early teen years. Like as a fat kid, Blubber was seminal. Blubber was like, like, you know, I mean, she spoke to me. And here's the thing about Judy Blume is, she aces the Bechdel test like no other author ever.
Yeah.
Blubber, I'm not sure. Other than maybe the dad, I don't think Blubber has male characters.
I don't really
know. And just like it's so, and as a 12-year-old reader, I'm not struggling for entry into the book.
Well, They did, because some of the kids in the class were
right, but you know what
boys,
I'm saying. You know what I'm saying, Chris.
They were, like, but they were completely inconsequential, except
right,
as
main
Blubber
was, characters.
Right. Joe, to your point, Blubber was a massively impactful book to me growing up because the notion of, you know, she gets in and she helps to bully this poor kid and torture them, and then as what happens in an ecosystem purely of carnivores, eventually you become the prey. Right. And then she gets bullied and tormented and realizes, oh, maybe I should not have been part of this whole thing. You know, I read that, I think, in fourth grade, when you're learning, like, there are people who are weaker than you. There are people who are stronger than you. You can choose to bully. You can choose to not bully. That book had such a profound impact on how I look at bullying. And it's such a visceral impact that it wasn't long after that. There's a moment where it was that year I read it. And then this kid in our neighborhood was bullying a friend of mine. And I'm like, well, that just tears it. And I went to the park and I beat the shit out of him. And then he and his friend met me at the park the next day. So I beat the shit out of both of them.
Nice.
I'm like,
hold on. We're going to get to the point where we stop believing you if you keep beating the shit out of people.
Like, no. How far does this go? To be fair, the sidekick he
brought. And then there were seven.
No, right.
They were ninjas.
Yeah, exactly.
I threw 30 stars. He knocked the katanas out of their hand. Yeah, no. To be fair, the second guy he brought was more like a toady. He was like a sidekick level.
Right, like the kid in Christmas Story.
Yeah. He wasn't bringing a whole. He was like, yeah, like Scott Farkas and his toady, and the other guy wasn't quite put together from the shellacking he got the day before, so he wasn't at 100% either. So I think together they were the same 100% that I felt the day before.
Good so, on you anyway.
But Bill, yeah, the whole point that I'm trying to get at with Judy Blume and Chris, this is to her genius, is that she lures you in with tales of a fourth grade nothing, and then you're super fudge, and you're like, oh, this is really wholesome, cool fare, and then all of a sudden you're in Blubber and Dini and Tiger Eyes, and you are coming of age, and there's people having sex, and there's contraception, and there's questions, and then are you there, God, it's me, Margaret, and people are bleeding out of their private parts, and what, my God, what is happening? Yeah. You know, I'm only 12.
Yeah. This is so disorienting.
I got trouble for that. But exactly the thing that you're describing, Joe. Like, I went and did, you know, tales. If you permit me two quick anecdotes, Chris, I know you will, like, I got dropped off at a cousin's house one time, like right after I had read Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing.
Oh, he's got fudge. Let's go.
No, she, you know, I was in her room because I was bored out of my mind. You know, I'm a reader and my cousins are, you know, doing whatever. And, you know, I go on her bookshelf is Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. So I pluck it down and start reading it. Before long, people realize I'm missing from whatever thing that they're doing, and they come up and they see me reading this book.
Reading a girl book.
A couple of minutes later, you know, her mom comes in my room and says, like, you're making Corey really uncomfortable reading that book. It has girl stuff in it, and I don't think it's appropriate for you. And, you know, I thought about it for a second, and then I said, well, you know, I started it. I got to finish it. And I just sat there and read the rest of the book in one sitting. Got
nice.
In trouble for that. But
I think, sorry, go ahead. No, I was just going to say, I think it's great that you guys all read Judy Blume, because I definitely think of her as like a writer for girls.
Oh, she,
not
absolutely.
To be all gendered about it. Yeah.
I never
thought. But like, it's great. Yeah. It's right. Really great that to find out that guys were reading it too. I mean, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I feel like that was really, you know,
it's a huge book. That's so important.
It's such a huge book. Yeah. And I mean, I knew about periods and whatnot to some extent, but like that book really, you know, laid it out for me. And also like the religion part of it, to my point before, like I grew up in a place that was very religious and I was not particularly religious. My mom goes to church now, but when we lived there, she didn't, because it was pretty much only evangelical Christians.
What we now call evangelicals, right?
Snake handlers.
Yeah, it was Baptist. Actually, it was Southern Baptist. Ooh. Is what I grew up
But
around.
I mean that, like, Liz, she's UU, right? Like, if I had to guess?
No.
Oh.
No, she, yeah, Presbyterian.
All right, well, yeah. New Jersey.
Yeah, same. Yeah. It's very like intellectual, you know, like it's
James
kind
Madison.
Of like an English class.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah. We didn't really have like a universalist Unitarian.
Yeah. Come to New England. That's all we have.
Yeah.
You can
yeah.
be Catholic
no,
or you can
I
be
like...
Unitarian Universalist, depending on your politics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm sorry.
No, Presbyterian. What I liked and what I liked about the book I'm going to talk about as well is like there is this religion in it, but there's also questions, right? And so I think that that was, for me, that was something that really resonated with me growing up in this very oppressive Southern Baptist town where I was not.
Yeah. Well, Liz, I'd love to go to you next, but before we do, Chris, do you have anything you'd like to add on Judy Blume?
I do, but I think Tom might have had one more story he wanted to tell.
Real quick, this is kind of...
That's right. No.
Flash forward to, like, you know, many years later when, you know, I now have a kid in elementary school, and I'm going into the teacher parent night, and you know they're talking about all this stuff that they're going to read, and they're going to read Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing. So like, I got to be hot shit, of course, and I've got to, you know, talk to the teacher. I'm like, well, what about Super Fudge? Turned out I didn't know that Super Fudge existed. So I'm like, okay, next day I'm going to be the hero. I'm like, how many kids in the class? Oh, there's 25. Okay, I'm getting 25 copies of Super Fudge, and I'm getting them shipped to the teacher's classroom. So I'm going to be the hero now. The kids are going to read Super Fudge too, and they're going to get the sequel in, and it's going to be super awesome, right? A few weeks later, through the Facebook Mom's Grapevine, I totally forgot that that book reveals that there's no Santa Claus. So guess who's to blame for telling everybody there's no Santa Claus?
Love it.
Bravo.
Man,
what
grade was he trying to be the hero? See what happens.
if you live long enough to be the villain in your own story.
Liz asked a really germane question here, Tom.
What grade was this? I missed what grade.
We're going into fourth grade. Yeah, that was Thomas was going.
Okay.
On the cusp. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny. Oh man.
I will tell you guys that I literally just now, because I don't have any of my books from when I was a kid. I just went and ordered the Judy Blume collection on Amazon just now because I have to go back and read them again.
Yeah.
My kids are 15 and 13. They'll never pick them up, but I'm going to.
I think we should do is this Christmas, we should all get, you know, Tom a copy of Super Fudge for Christmas. That's what we should do.
25 of them.
25 of them, exactly.
Can you imagine? Hundreds of them.
Exactly. Here, Tom, go ruin the holiday for a whole other generation. Love the boys.
Here's your crate of Super Fudge.
Here's the last thing I want to say about Judy Blume.
Yeah.
We were talking about Blubber. Blubber was banned because parents thought that it was troublesome that someone could act badly and not face punishment. Like that's a bad example to show to kids. And what that amounts to is a self-indictment, because that is how the friggin' world works.
Yes, it is.
People that act bad are generally not punished. Bullies are generally not punished. We let them get away with it. And Judy Blume held the mirror up, and the parents didn't like the mirror. Yeah. And that is, I think, at the heart of a whole lot of what we're talking about.
I would just like to point out that when like people our age were reading Blubber, right? As an instance of like, oh, well, you know, you know, the notion of bad things happening, not being punished. Well, that's, we don't like that example at all. Hey, guess what? Our parents were super checked out at the time. They were latchkey. They weren't doing shit.
You are providing that example every minute.
Exactly. It's like, how dare you guys presume that the system is going to work to protect us kids? Because nothing protects us kids, man. I'm at home 2 o'clock by myself in an empty house making crackers and peanut butter like an animal because there's nobody around here to look after me. Okay. Don't tell me that, like, if some jerk comes and roughs me up at work at school, like there's some Justice League in the hall that's going to stop and get involved. Right. There isn't, there wasn't, there was never going to be. Just quit playing.
I will say too, the last thing about Judy Blume is the fearlessness with which she said it's okay to talk about X, whether that was bullying or menstruation.
And she's like, still doing it.
Then again, maybe I won't. She was talking about math anxiety 25 years before anybody entered that into the vernacular of pedagogy. Like, I mean, she just, I don't know. She was like a superhero.
You guys might laugh at this comparison, but I think of Judy Blume in much the same way that I think of Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers.
Yeah.
It just in the sense that, like, she spoke to her audience as an adult
where
and to them as understanding where they were as kids, but never talking down to them and speaking to them in a way that really understood, like, I know what you're going through. I've been there. I've not forgotten. And she really guided kids on their own terms. And when I read Judy Blume, it was so immediate to me. I had never read something that felt like it was written for me at where I was, you know, and just where I was intellectually. That was her remarkable gift and her remarkable talent. And she honed that skill. And as a writer, I immensely, immensely respect her ability to connect with her audience on such a consistently deep and authentic level. So with that, I think we're going to hand over, Liz, you're talking about what you wanted to pick. So I'd love to hand the mic over to you. So let's go to you about and talk about the book that you've decided to bring up today. Walk us through a little bit about who wrote it, what it's about, talk about why it was banned, and then, you know, talk a little bit about who you think would really benefit from reading it today.
Okay. I picked a book that probably no one has ever heard of, A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline Lingle. I loved this book so much. I loved the whole series so much that I broke the binding on it. I have, like, I volunteered at when my daughter was in elementary school, I volunteered at the school library, and they had a copy of, I think it was A Swiftly Tilting Planet, with the same cover that I had when I was a kid.
And
I mean, oh my God. No, I took a picture. Obviously, I didn't steal it.
She probably hugged it, though. I guess you stop and you held it close to your chest, right? Like, it's okay, old friend.
Yes,
I'm with you again.
I did. Oh,
yes,
my gosh.
That's what I'm talking about.
And the cover that the one that I have with me is not the same, but it's fine. I mean, I know that this is a book that many, many people loved, but to give just a little synopsis of it, it is about this girl, Meg Murray. I think she's like 15, and her family, she has twin brothers and then a younger brother who's like 5 in this book. Although, let me tell you, I was like, I'm just going to skim through this a little bit today. And then 4 hours later, I'm halfway through it. Yeah. So again, I'm going to break the binding.
That happens with me with
Lloyd
Alexander. Yeah.
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 So good.
Charles Murray is the 5-year-old precocious brother. And I'm sorry, I am saying his name wrong. Charles something.
Charles Wallace, right?
Charles Wallace Murray. They call him Charles. Thank you. So anyway, everyone in the community thinks that he's kind of an idiot, but in fact, he's of course a genius. And she feels very odd and awkward. But the primary issue is that her dad has been missing for a year, and so the family is sort of like going along, but something weird has happened to him. And then these 3 supernatural beings show up, Ms. What's-its, Ms. Who, and Mrs. Witch. And they take them on this journey through time and space to save her father or their father. And what I loved about it, there are a couple things that I really loved about it. One is that it's hard to describe the genre of it. Like it's fantasy, but it's also science fiction, but also some of the science is real. So in one of the later books, they talk about mitochondria. That was the first time I think I had ever heard the word mitochondria. This has tesseract, and she kind of plays with what it means, but it's, tesseract is a real term that is used for real science stuff.
Yeah.
English major, so you know, science stuff.
Hey,
math,
speak for yourself.
Yeah. So I loved that it has this, it's hard to define what it is. And actually, that's one of the reasons that it almost, like, she had a hard time publishing it, because no one knew how to define it. So they didn't know how to market it. So it took a long time for her to get it published. And the other thing that I really liked about it, two more things. One is that it's like a big family. I'm an only child, and like the love in that family is so overwhelming I just, it really spoke to me as someone who just sort of like was by myself, right? And the family loves each other so much, and it's so clear, even though they call each other stupid and morons and dumb and whatever, like you can see how much they love each other. And I also, the one reason that I loved it, which is one of the reasons that it was banned, is that there were complaints that it was both too religious and not religious enough. So there's a section in there where they're talking about, where the three supernatural beings are talking about people who have lived on Earth, who have been helping to fight this evil, the black thing, right? And so one of the people is Jesus. And then they're like, oh yes, definitely Jesus, but also other people. And then they start saying like Shakespeare, Copernicus, all these, Gandhi, Einstein, Buddha, all these things. And so the complaint was that it was putting Jesus on the same level as all of the other things, whereas they believe that Jesus should be on a higher level. And seems silly. And it's not really banned anymore. It was really banned from like 1990 to 1999. It was ranked 23rd of most frequently banned books or challenge books, and then 90 from 2000 to 2009. So I think that, you know, it's old enough now that people are okay with it.
People have come to like, terms with the existence of other religions.
I guess we're fine with that now.
Y'all gotta figure this thing out, okay? There are other people out there who don't believe in Jesus, okay? It's hard to understand, but they do. So, when I read A Wrinkle in Time, I remember, you know, Chris, you're saying before how your elementary school library was such an important place to you. It was to me as well. I mean, that's where I encountered many of the books that had a massive impact on me and made me a reader. By the way, this is why librarians and school librarians in particular matter so much. My school librarian picked up on the fact that I was a voracious reader, and she goes, hey, you should read this book. She gave me A Wrinkle in Time. I think you're going to really like it. And it shattered me. It blew me to pieces. I had never read anything like it. And to your point, like I was like, it's all over the place. And so I quickly read, at that point, I read everything up to a Swiftly Tilting Planet, which I think that was that's all they had. Right. But you know, at a time, he said, like, it's not science fiction, it's not fantasy, it's not sci-fi. It's what you would now call speculative fiction, right? But that category didn't really exist back then. But a lot more spec fiction exists now. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, where do you think A Wrinkle in Time lands in today's publishing space, as far as like kids who are ready for that kind of fiction, they're ready for that sort of speculative fiction, and then when I dive into it, does it still hold up against there, because it's such a broader field of other speculative fiction books out there
people have been really cashing in on this.
but I mean, just there's so much more out there. You think, does Wrinkle in Time still hold its own against all that other stuff?
Well, it's funny you say that, because my daughter had to read it in like seventh grade with along with Rebecca Steed's When You Reach Me, which is a book that takes heavily from this book. And when she finished it, I said, A Wrinkle in Time, did you love it? And she said, do you want me to tell you the truth, or do you want me to say I loved it? Oh, and I was like,
man,
it sounds like my first wife.
You're dead to me.
Which is that she loved it. And she's like, I can't do that. She did not like it.
Opposite experience. Yeah. So, like, this was one of the first, you know, books like I bought for Kate, my oldest, my daughter, and I gave it to her, and like she ordinarily will reject any of my recommendations out of hand, but I got her like a set. You know, it had a Swiftly Tilting Planet in it. It had, what's the other one, like A Wind at the Door or something like that.
In the Door. Yeah.
And she loved A Wrinkle in Time. She had a ball with it. So,
oh, it's so good to hear you.
I was happy.
But I will say, one of my colleagues is also reading it, and she's reading it with her daughter. I forget what grade her daughter's in. And I said, well, what do you think of it? And she said that she fine. There's parts of it that she was like, oh, I don't think that they would do that today. Like, a Calvin calls Charles Wallace a moron several times, right? So, like, is that something that they would throw in today's, like, fiction? I mean, maybe, but we're supposed to like Calvin.
It's the kind of thing, right? That, so, like, you know, in a Roald Dahl book would now be bowdlerized, right?
Let's not.
Yeah,
stop
maybe.
It.
Yeah. Stop it. But I do think, stop I mean, it. I do think that there are parts of it that are dated, but to me, it's like such a classic in that it was the start of something.
Yeah.
Right. Like, yeah. It was the start of this. So I think that, do you need to read it to read other speculative fiction? No. But if you want to know more of the history of how speculative fiction came about, then I think that's, you know, then it's definitely worth reading for that, yeah. for that yeah. purpose.
I've got to believe
but
that.
But I still love it.
Oh, yeah. No, no, you know, it's funny. When you said you're going to talk about this book, I was like, oh, it's such a good one. But the thing is, I haven't revisited it in, gosh, a really, really, really long time.
Did you not see the film, Bill?
You know, I didn't.
Nobody did.
But
I did.
I did.
I
saw an Oprah movie.
Yeah.
I saw it. I saw that was coming out. It looked interesting. I just missed it. But it wasn't like I was like, oh, I don't want to watch it. I just, like many movies nowadays, I simply just missed it. So I'll catch it eventually. But, you know, but I do recall, though, there were some Christian columns out there who were like, oh, we really don't like they scrub so much of the God stuff out of this thing. And so to your point, like, this thing's come full circle. Like, once upon a time it was taking liberties. Now they're like, wait a minute, don't get rid of the God stuff. I'm like, guys, take your pick, man. Please leave this book alone.
That's like
the Disney version. They did really take a lot of it out.
Yeah, yeah. So well, it's been adapted more than once, right? I think there's like a TV adaptation of it, like like 10 or 20 years ago. That I recall that, like, I think Madeline L'Engle actually came out and said she didn't like it. Like she didn't, but this is like an earlier, like a Disney TV version, not the motion picture that just came out. Yeah. I could be wrong, but yeah. So but Liz, any more thoughts on Wrinkle in Time, especially in terms of, you know, its banning, you know, where it lands with you. I mean, even though your daughter savagely just, you know, didn't like it. Oh God, so harsh. Is this still a book you would recommend to people her age?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really liked what the teacher did in her class, which is pairing it with When You Reach Me by Rebecca State. It's a really great companion to read with it. I don't want to give too much away of it, but it pulls a lot from A Wrinkle in Time. So yeah absolutely.
But I think we're beyond the spoiler statute of limitations here, Liz.
What I will say is that, like, when someone comes in, a kid comes in, I tend to ask them, what kind of stuff do you like? So, like, if they said, I like realistic fiction, no, this is not going to be the book that I give them. If they say, I like fantasy or sci-fi, then yes, either one of those, I feel like I would give them something like this. Dystopian, you know, no, probably not.
Liz, I mean, I know that this really ought to be like a basic function of the librarian, but it never honestly occurred to me to ask a librarian what I might want to read. Never at any point in my childhood or since.
Yeah,
same. You were more well-read.
We have a whole thing called Reader's Advisory, Chris, where it's like we learn how to get information out of people to help give them
the original Alexa algorithm. Books.
Right.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
You've got an algorithm.
You might want ball gags. You know, yeah. Like what is that? What?
And like I at work, I'll make little flyers that are like, if you like, I don't know, if you can't get Lessons in Chemistry, which is a big book that people are reading now, here are some other books that you can read while you're waiting on the list for that. So yeah, I do stuff
like
that.
I feel like Harry Potter tried Divergent.
In my job.
Yeah. I feel like I should go down to my library and pick like the three most disparate books I can possibly find, right? And then in my car, drive up to where Liz is working and walk in like, okay, triangulate around these. What should I read?
What's next?
What does the algorithm say?
Exactly. What is the Well, Liz is the oracle. So what does the oracle tell me to read? You know.
So here's what I'll say like, is
the exit sign.
Well, after you leave, we will talk about you.
Outstanding. All right, cool. So I think that leaves us with Joe. So Joe, why don't you talk us through the book you picked? Give us a quick rundown of what it's all about. Why do you love it so much? And talk about its banning and your thoughts on that.
Yeah, the first thing I'll say is that I think the theme of tonight is that banning books is really stupid. You can't look any further than the fact that like Charlotte's Web has been banned.
I know. Why?
Right.
Because animals talking is blasphemous.
That's witchcraft, man.
Brown bear, what do you see has been banned. Now, in all fairness, that was a mistake because Bill Martin Jr., who wrote that book, was confused with Bill Martin, who wrote A Marxist Critique of Capitalism. And it took some time for the Kansas Board of Education to figure out that they'd made a mistake.
Oh. But you mean there could be two Bill Martins?
Of course. Impossible.
Banning books.
We know they're both communists.
Banning books is ridiculously idiotic. And I think that's axiomatic for what we're talking about. The book that I want to talk about is The Cider House Rules. This is a 1985 book by John Irving. It tells of a young orphan, Homer Wells, who grows up at an orphanage in Maine where the head doctor, Wilbur Larch, performs abortions. Homer becomes Larch's protege and assists the doctor with a variety of services. After assisting with his first abortion, Homer informs his mentor that he will never do another one. And the book follows Homer's life and coming of age, both in and out of the orphanage at St. Cloud. Part of why I love the book is because, as I've said many times on this podcast, Irving is my favorite contemporary author and a sizable inspiration for my own work. The Cider House Rules is my second favorite of his books. The story is set in Maine, but the apple orchard where Homer goes to work and later finds himself performing an abortion for the raped daughter of a migrant apple picker is based on Applecrest here in New Hampshire, which is less than 10 miles from where I live and where Irving once worked as a young man. The book contains Irving's usual brilliant prose and his usual loving depiction of New England geography and culture. It's also an unflinching look at abortion, race, class, and a host of other thorny social issues. This undoubtedly is what led it to be landed on the banned book lists in two Texas school districts just this past year. By the way, this book was written and released in 1985 and never was challenged, never was banned until last year. A guy by the name of Matt Krause, a state representative in Texas, started asking school leaders to identify the number of copies of hundreds of specific books they had sitting on their library shelves and how much money the districts paid to purchase those books.
Uh-oh.
Krause asked the districts to provide information about books that deal with sexuality, sexually transmitted diseases, AIDS, HIV, and, quote, material that might make students feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress because of their race or sex. So basically, we have the culture war percolating and bubbling up to the point where we're going looking for trouble. This isn't like, yeah, oh, here's a book kids are reading. This is like, let me go try to find books that I disagree with and use them.
That can make a reader feel distressed.
Yeah. Let's gillnet literature.
Right, and it is. It's like essentially legislative.
People, librarians do all the work of finding the books that we want to ban. Yeah, that makes sense.
So,
I put three offensive books on the counter and asked Liz to find me a fourth one, and she wouldn't, and I'm so mad.
Cider House Rules is a beautiful book. It tackles abortion head on. Like, I mean, in the early portions of the book, and I don't know if anybody's read it, but in the early portions of the book, it goes into excruciating detail about the DNC procedure that was, for most of the 20th century, how abortions were conducted. And it talks about, like, you know, the doctor and Homer, his young protege, scraping the uterine wall, you know, with their tool and the gritty feel. Like, it goes all the way. I mean, it's so evocative. If you are an opponent of abortion and you read this book, you would find a ton of grist to support your position. Because everybody who has an abortion, everybody who conducts an abortion, is forever changed by the experience. It is an unflinching look at how the ending of a pregnancy changes everybody involved with that. And there's more. There's more to the book, because this is John Irving, and
there's always more.
nobody can ever tell a 3-word story in 1,000 words like John Irving. Like, this guy just, he Stephen King and John Irving are probably the two contemporary authors who editors have thrown their hands up in the air and said, yeah, okay, whatever. Like, print your money. Okay, I'm not going to stop it. I can't. Yeah. But abortion, adoption, sexuality, war injuries, race, because he ends up working at the main character, Homer, winds up working at an apple orchard where he interacts with the migrant workers. And it's just, Irving has a talent for putting his finger on whatever hot button issue he wants to, and usually several at once. And so this book is one that, yeah, you know what? If you're tender, don't read it. Don't come here. But if you're curious, and if you want to, you know, come face to face with a lot of stuff that where we divide each other and where we suffer from pain, open the cover.
Joe, I'm not surprised that an opportunistic politician from Texas, of all places, would dragnet the body of modern literature to find something that he might find objectionable in some way, shape, or form to make hay out of all that. That doesn't surprise me. What surprises me is that, given the subject matter of the book, and given that abortion has been a hot button topic for no small amount of time before then, it didn't really attract the kind of attention, you know, before, right? And it's like, this current effort to ban it just strikes me as particularly spurious and craven, you know, to be perfectly honest with you. Because not like the guy read it, not like the guy just was walking through the airport and it just happened to land on his desk and he read it. He was gillnetting, right? But you're particularly, as somebody with a real keen political mind, you're really attuned to how these issues affect public discourse and that sort of thing. And I'm kind of curious, why do you think a book of this kind didn't get that kind of reaction when it first came out, or in the years since then? Why did it have to wait until now, when all kinds of hacks are trying to find books to ban because it's like it gets them with some sort of weird political cred? Why did the Cider House Rules not ping on the radar before?
I think it had too many words in it for a long time. And that
I want to say you're joking, but I know you're not.
I'm not in the slightest. Yeah. And it took until 2021 when this
someone finally finished it.
When this
14 years later, son of a bitch.
Oh my God, what are they talking about? But that's when I honestly think in 21, 22, when this representative, part of what they did was they went to Liz librarians throughout Texas and said, what are books that deal with sexuality, abortion, these other wedge controversial issues? And in a couple of districts, I think the librarian said they put on their list, right? Like, Cider House Rules addresses abortion. And so then it percolated up and found its way on its list. You know, it's a fishing expedition. All of this stuff is.
Yeah, yeah.
There's almost never, I think, a real sincere interest in banning a book. Like it's always about power.
Yeah. I have to wonder, though. I mean, John Irving is a very grown-up writer, writing very grown-up stories for very grown-up readers. And I kind of wonder, I mean, so much of the book banning going on right now, it's very much books written really aimed at the young adult audience.
What high school library has the Cider House Rules?
Right. So I think I'm kind of wondering, like, does the literary level of the book, I mean, Irving's not an easy read, right? So I'm wondering, you mentioned too many words, but like, could it just be a matter of the sophistication of the tale is such that it kind of provides a certain armor from the low-hanging fruit of book bans.
It's a whole lot easier to read a child's book.
Sure. I will tell you.
I mean, Toni Morrison gets banned all the time.
Well, that's because she's black.
Yeah, she's a black woman, though.
It's easy to go, poetry by a black woman must be bad.
Yeah, but, yeah, exactly.
But the thing about
good point.
The thing about the Cider House rules is that its take on abortion and war and race is nuanced. It's not wholly anti-pro, like it tackles a whole bunch of stuff in very nuanced and very radiant ways. I don't expect nuance from any elected official anywhere ever. I think it took a librarian to raise their hand and say, this is a little weird. This is a little, you know, maybe you might want this on your list. I don't know. And then it percolated up from there.
Yeah. Yeah. Has any of Irving's other work ever, you know, kind of gotten banned?
No, which blows my mind.
It kind of blows my mind. I mean, like World According to GARP, right? Like, well, like I'm
Hotel
surprised.
New Hampshire, which is basically incestuous rape.
Yeah, like, and he tracks in kind of taboo territory. Well, so I'm surprised he hasn't been.
Owen Meany is as anti-war as you can possibly get, and includes incest and other stuff. So like, it's all opportunistic.
Detecting a theme.
Yeah, well, look, Irving was sexually abused as a kid. And
New Englanders,
sorry.
I'm sorry, but that's the first time I've ever said sexually abused as a kid, followed by laughter.
Yeah, here's what happened. The joke formed in my head, right? It was down the pipeline going out of my mouth. As it fired off, right, you dropped that little nugget about Irving, and I'm like, I just dropped the worst joke of my life, and I wish I could take it back. I don't know how to take that one back,
guys.
That was not the time for that joke. So I really feel quite awful about it, and I think I'm just going to hide with the desk for the rest of the episode.
When he was sexually abused by someone in his family, you know, and informed his later prose. I don't know how to make that into a joke. But Prayer for Owen Meany, which is my favorite Irving of all time, is, oh my God, it's deeply anti-Christian, anti-war, anti-family. Like, you're going to ban a book, ban that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Like,
I love that book too. Yeah.
Oh my God.
They're not in a lot of school libraries, though, I would imagine. Not in a lot.
Well, I was first pointing toward.
Liz?
No, I was going to say, I've seen high schools give Owen Meany as an option to read.
Especially in AP lit courses, right? Like, I mean, it's one of those. But like, I was first given A Prayer for Owen Meany by my freshman homeroom teacher, who was a English teacher, who said, you need to read this. At which point I read the first half and said, I can't stand it. And then came back to it later when I was older. If nothing else, it brings sharp focus on the fact that banning books is political opportunism far more than anything relative to the content of the books on the chopping block.
Yeah.
This is funny. You know, we mentioned that I mentioned earlier, we're recording this on Mother's Day, and I was at my mom's today for a while, where we both revisited her, you know, now held together by scotch tape, copy of Catcher in the Rye. And we've been having this text conversation because, you know, my mom is like directly responsible for my love of reading. I mean, like, if you're going to credit somebody, it's her. You know, she was always the one bringing books back for me, you know, from the bookstore. You know, The Catcher in the Rye is one of her favorite books of all time. And she was very surprised to hear that it was a banned book. It was the most banned book for over two decades, at the same time that it was also the second most taught book in America, which is just bonkers to me, because now you got this sort of like, you know, either it was banned in your school district or everybody loved it and they were teaching it, which seems really,
Mason
really
Dixon. I don't know. All I know is you're a phony, Tom.
Brad later hanging out. Yeah. We're
I wonder if it got banned so much because it was being taught so much. Like, if that was what got people to take a look at it, like, what are you reading? Oh, Catcher in the Rye. What's this about? Oh, wait a minute. Hang on. And then people flip out and
it's about toxic.
You know, their conversation was around a lot of like,
it's about an asshole.
The real reason, you know,
Holden Caulfield is an asshole.
There's profanity. There's a ton of profanity in that book. There's some sexual content in that book. There's plenty to just be, you know, to be very, you know, to be contentious about within that book. But like, in the context of today or even other books that were being banned at the time, like, I don't think it's that bad. I think it was because they just didn't like Holden Caulfield's independence and independence of thought and all that.
Right.
I that's what it was.
Questioning adults is bad. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. There was a time when that was alone just like enough to get a
it's
book.
Just bad to be no, a, we'll
it's go back bad. To Beverly. I mean, Beverly Clear or, yeah, Beverly Cleary. The Ramona books have been banned because they presented a child who disobeyed her parents on the regular.
I think they, but I think it's because Holden Caulfield's a slacker, and like, you know, it's we got the we have the Principal Strickland approach. Like, you know, what are you, a slacker?
Too many kids read this. I'm not going to ship off to minimum wage jobs anytime soon. So we try to get this book off the shelves. So yeah.
I love that my mom is a product of religious school, you know, loved that book and loved that about that character. So says
Liz.
All I'm going to say about Catcher in the Rye is that I did tell my daughter that if you date someone who's over like 25 and they say that Catcher in the Rye is their favorite book.
red flag.
Yeah.
That is 10 out of 10 advice from Liz Miller, mother of the podcast.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
Until like 25, fine. But like after that, no. It's like,
No, wave off, man.
sorry to Tom's mom.
Oh, well, that's a topic we should come back to. Books we grew out of.
Add it to the list.
Basically a Guilty Pleasures episode.
We're asking you back for that one.
I'm taking
that. Books you grew out of. That'd be a good one. Figure that one out.
One's mine.
Ayn Rand. Yeah. Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand discography.
I say with no small amount of pride, I never read either of those massive bullet stopping Ayn Rand books, but gosh, like 15 years ago, I had a colleague and I was talking about how I never read Ayn Rand. She's like, you haven't? I'm like, well, why should I? She goes, no, it's a good point. I said, there are these massive tracts and I'm not going to agree with her whatsoever. And I hear they're terrible. She goes, all you got to do is read Anthem. You read Anthem, right? That tells you everything you need to know about Ayn Rand and a fraction of the period. Everything else is just wasted space. Read that, you understand Ayn Rand, and you can basically lay claim to having read all of her books. And I read Anthem, and I suspect she's right. Like, I think Maya, if you're out there, thank you very much for saving my time, because I appreciate that.
You really, really grasp how bankrupt Rand's philosophy is.
Yeah, how intellectually threadbare her whole worldview really can be. And you mean, this is nonsense. Like, what am I doing? So,
what is wrong with you, woman?
I have a great Ayn Rand story that if you invite me back on, I will maybe be too embarrassed to tell you, but maybe not. You'll have to see.
Liz Miller?
We will ply you with alcohol until it comes.
Yeah, right. Seriously. Yes. What a way to invite yourself back onto the show. Yes. Absolutely. Do we want Liz back on and tell the embarrassing Ayn Rand story? Yes, we do. Bill, how did you
so, come with an, oh my God.
How did you get an Ayn Rand episode on Moments of Truth? Well, it's a funny Paul thing Verlaine. You should ask.
Okay? Learn more.
Funny story.
Yeah. It was the opportunity to extort a funny story out of our friend Liz. So that's how we did that. Yeah. So anyway.
Want to learn more? Click here.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, look, before we go, a final thought. In 1807, Dr. Thomas Bodler and his sister Henrietta Maria released The Family Shakespeare, a revised edition of Shakespeare's plays that removed anything they deemed to be excessively racy, violent, or blasphemous. While The Family Shakespeare had plenty of critics, it was sufficiently popular that other folks produced other sanitized versions of works of literature that were more in step with Victorian sensibilities. This finally changed nearly 100 years later when writer Richard Whiting wrote a legendary takedown of The Family Shakespeare in the August 1916 issue of the English Review, in which he describes the Bodler's edits as having, quote, about as much critical discrimination as you might expect from a baby playing with a pair of shears, end quote. Seriously, go to archive.org and look it up. You will never find a more artfully delivered piece of assassin-level literary criticism than this. It's so very good. Whiting's review crystallized public opinion against A Family Shakespeare so thoroughly that it formally injected into the English language the word Bodlerize, which is to remove potentially offensive content from something in a way that damages the original. One can hardly imagine a more fitting legacy for such self-righteous editors. Now, nobody was banning Shakespeare at the time or even much calling for it. A family Shakespeare was born of the Baudelaire's own meddling morality and enabled by the intellectual laziness of a public that went along with the defacement of their nation's greatest literary genius. The whole episode is a good example of how true censorship may be the most sinister form of creative restraint, but self-censorship is the most pitiful. Case in point, earlier this year, the Daily Telegraph reported that it had discovered hundreds of edits across the current editions of the works of Roald Dahl, the author of classics such as Matilda, James and the Giant Peach, and of course, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Penguin Random House, Dahl's publisher, removed words like fat, ugly, crazy, and generally rewrote any prose that it considered offensive to modern sensibilities. This wasn't in response to some kind of challenge. Penguin just felt this was necessary to make globally beloved literary classics relevant to readers. Now, the truth is, Dahl's work, wonderful as it is filled with dark humor, bleak weirdness, and an undercurrent of misanthropy, racism, and misogyny that spares no one, not even kids. So if you can get past all that and enjoy the work on its own terms, well, then you're good to go. You know, Dahl is hardly the most, he's hardly the only complicated author out there whose worldview and whose work have fallen out of alignment with modern audiences. And as objectionable as the guy can be, let's be honest, all right? He is no H.P. Lovecraft. Still, that wasn't enough for Penguin, which in Baudelaireizing Dahl's work robbed it of so much of the richness that makes Dahl, Dahl. The Telegraph's expose sparked an intense international backlash that included the Queen Consort, UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, and author Salman Rushdie, who probably understands the effects of literary censorship better than anyone. Under such withering criticism, Penguin announced it would republish Dahl's original unedited works, but the edited versions would remain in their children's line, Puffin, which, of course, is where they will do the most damage. Penguin is still in the wrong here. But, you know, three cheers for the Telegraph for pointing this out, and three cheers more to everyone who demanded Dahl's work remain as is for audiences young and old to evaluate on their own. When a publisher buys an author's work, it may have the contractual right to alter it however it likes, but the moral right? Only a Baudelaireite would grant themselves that. This has been Moments of Truth. On behalf of myself, Tom, Chris, Joe, and Liz Miller, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time. Moments of Truth is hosted by Bill Coffin, Chris Crenshaw, Tom Hespos, and Joe Pace. This podcast is edited by Derek Eisenhart. The Moments of Truth theme is a mashup of The Claremont by Flash Flaherty and a little help from a Texas Instruments Speak and Spell. For more Moments of Truth, be sure to subscribe to this show wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or check us out on YouTube or at momentsoftruth.show. And now, a little crass commercialism. Thanks for listening.
3, 2, 1. Dollars.
When Andy Chester loses his young wife Lisa to breast cancer, he finds himself on a grief journey with no certain destination. As he confronts his greatest fears about death, Andy must reckon with the possibility that there may be no life after Lisa. Read After Lisa, the new novel by best-selling author Joe Pace, available now on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
Susie Faulkner has fought against the darkness her whole life, but will her skills be enough against her evil equal? Never Back Down, number 3 in the Faulkner Family Thriller Series by Christopher Swan, available now.
Experience 53 of the greatest weird fiction short stories ever published by Mary Shelley, H.P. Lovecraft, Gray Lespina, Ambrose Bierce, and many more in Tales from the Outer Canon, a new weird fiction anthology edited by Bill Coffin. Get Tales from the Outer Canon today on Amazon or for free on archive.org.